I'm going to open us in prayer. Lord Father, thank you for this opportunity to teach your word and your message. Like Wallace, I do pray that this will be entirely of the Spirit, that this will be entirely of you, Lord. But I pray that you will work through me and move through me, Lord. All power and wisdom are yours, and I pray that your guidance and power and wisdom be with me today. Thank you for your continued blessing on this congregation, Lord. Thank you for all the ways you watch over us. Lord, I do pray that you continue to watch over Wallace and Linda as they travel and bring them back to us, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. So it happened again. This is my third time doing this, and I was pretty much done. I was a little behind where I wanted to be, but I was pretty much done. And then on Thursday, I made a day trip up to Pittsburgh, went up and back in the same day, had this wonderful demonstration with a new technology that I've been championing at work. And after it had gone really well, and I sat in this conference room, the CEO of this company, his primary advisor, and the PM on the project, and we sat there around the table talking about things, and as we moved on through, it became pretty apparent pretty quickly, all of a sudden, that we were all Christians. You know, and that's just not what you expect. And then, as you know, so the fact that I was going to be preaching today came up, and they had a lot to say about the topic. And so all of a sudden, I'm like, this is a divine appointment. And I started writing things down that these guys are saying. And one of them was an elder in his church. The other one was very senior in his church. And I had to rewrite it again on Thursday. God is never quite happy with what I put together. This is what I'm learning from this. And so my talk today is about faith and how everything, even not believing in God, requires faith. In that meeting, that one of them mentioned that someone had said to him, the difference between the evidence you have and what you believe is faith, and that we all do that. I have a slide for that. Go ahead. Okay? This is the evidence, but you believe something. And the fact is, we can prove very few things completely. And when I say we, I'm not talking about Christians. I'm talking about humans. Christians and non-Christians, there are very few things that we can absolutely prove. I can prove this chair is here, right? I'm not talking about that kind of thing, but there's very few things. And so we all do this thing, and yet we do believe these things. My goal today is to show you that the jump for non-Christians in what they choose to believe is larger, honestly, more desperate than the jump that we make in faith. I admit, I sometimes joke, there's four elders, Wallace and Greg we have, so that we have spiritual things covered. Carlos we have, so that the business stuff is covered. And I'm around just in case nuclear physics questions come up. I am kind of the sciencey elder, and I'm going to get a little technical every once in a while today, but I worked really hard to try and keep it light, and I'm going to try and make sure no one's eyes glaze over. But we'll see. When I started high school, I was an atheist. And you could hear me talk to people about how some people needed this thing they call faith. I was going to rely on science and facts, right? What I didn't appreciate is, as I mentioned, atheism is a religious belief. And it takes faith, faith that there is no God. I have a slide about trusting science. Go ahead. Blindly trusting just about anything is wrong. Trusting science is not the problem. Trusting that there is only science and that there is not an invisible God, that's faith. And it ignores a lot of evidence that says otherwise. It's contrary, and as I mentioned before, it really takes a larger leap of faith than believing in God. So I wanted to inspect some of those leaps with you. In early high school, I thought and literally would preach to my friends that I would rely on facts and science rather than some mystical being that others seemed to need. But as I learned more of the world, more of science, as I learned more about the amazing order of things, I came to realize that it was too improbable for it to possibly exist without a designer. And so I started looking for the designer. That's always a mistake when you start looking for God, because you just might find him. And that brings me to my first verse. And I do have very few verses today, which is unusual for me. But Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal powers and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. That was what brought me to faith. Was looking at the universe and seeing the design and seeing what it meant. I think I remember the first time I read this verse as a Christian, recognizing that this was the force that I'd felt that had brought me to belief. You know, I certainly remember reading it later and early in my Christian walk, that kind of stuff. Wallace, when talking about his father one day said, you know, son, you don't have to convince me there's a God. I look at the stars and the sky, and I know there's a God. What Wallace had to do was convince him that this was the God, which, as we know, Wallace has mentioned he did. And Wallace is watching or will be watching, so I hope I kind of captured that right. For me, it was studying physics and science that proved to me there was God. Jordan Peterson is a Canadian psychiatrist, author, and commutator. This came to him looking at the metaphysical instead of the physical. But he came to the same conclusion. I was watching a bit of an interview with him, and he was asked, what is the best argument for atheism? He said, there is no good argument for atheism. It's based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the world. It is an illegal chess move. He says, what he's saying is that if you look at the world enough, if you look at people and the inherent beliefs in people, okay, there has to be a God behind it or it makes no sense. He's basically saying that it's the equivalent of cheating in chess. And I actually have an example of that too. You just imagine arguing with this person. Right? But people do try to believe that there is no God. So I wanted to turn and look at some of the science that is used to disprove the Christian narrative. So I'm going to start with the Big Bang and the origins of the universe. Discover magazine in April 2002 proclaimed on its cover, the universe burst into something from absolutely nothing, zero, nada. And as it got bigger, it became filled with even more stuff that came from absolutely nowhere. How is that possible? Ask Alan Guth. His theory of inflation helps explain everything. Just in case you don't believe me, I found that cover. There it is. It burst into something from absolutely nothing, zero, nada. You want to talk about a leap of faith? Okay? These are the same people who say, well, Christians believe in miracles. I believe in facts, right? No, my friend, that's a miracle. So you want to talk about believing in miracles? Yeah, I just said this. All right, and it doesn't matter how hard you look at the Big Bang. At some point, you have to get something from nothing to get the Big Bang. Okay? And the more we have learned about thermodynamics, okay, the more and more we prove that you had to get something from nothing, and the leap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. We're not finding things that are solving these things. We're finding more and more holes, very honestly. The theory includes an initial expansion of matter that it can't explain how it came into being. It also can't explain why that matter started moving. Then the matter had to slow down. It actually can't explain why matter moving rapidly outward in a vacuum slows. Okay? And then gases had to start coalescing and forming these stars. But gases in hot environments tend to expand and distribute instead of coalesce. And so they were like, so these were three miracles that have to happen in Big Bang in order for Big Bang to be true. So what do? They create this stuff called dark matter. Okay, that's how the stars form. There's this matter that we can't see, doesn't interact with light, can't detect, have never proven, but it has a lot of gravity exactly where you need it in order to create the stars. Guess what? We don't know how it got there. We don't know how it slowed. We don't know why it was so concentrated. We don't know why we can't find it. It's magic, not science. Okay? Turning to origins of life. There are Christians who believe in evolution. And very early on, I was one of them. When I was in school, evolution was known as the theory of evolution. It was taught with possible explanation of the origin of life on the planet, and some of its flaws were openly discussed and explained and examined. Now it's evolution, all caps, all facts, no doubts. The door on the debate is closed. But I have noticed when one side closes a door on a debate, that's usually because they knew they were losing, right? And so back during the weeks leading up to Easter, I told a story of people who challenged Christianity and then themselves became Christians. And that's the danger of not closing the door. You might accidentally step through it, right? And so this college professor that I talked about back then was an atheist. He was a prominent Christian. When a prominent Christian physicist came to the college, they started becoming friends. And so he had all the arguments for evolution all down pat. He knew these cold. And so he went ahead and started meeting with this guy. They had this budding friendship, and he was going to help the guy see the light. He found the man receptive to the conversation, but also found that he was more than capable of defeating every argument he brought up. okay, against God, against creation, he could muster. He struggled with the logic and the evidence that his colleagues shared. He struggled, and how much his logic and what he had thought had was evidence faded under the Christian argument. He eventually became a Christian. One of the big ones that challenges this way of thinking in order to do evolution is that life has to come from non-life. And this is something we have no example of. We've never seen it, etc. So to try and prove this, they've done experiments. And what they do is they create the conditions they think might have happened during the primordial Earth. Well, that's the first problem. These are the conditions we think might be there. But it's okay. I'll give them that. Okay? And they have hot water and lava and lightning strikes and that kind of stuff. And they get organic molecules, get formed. And I'm like, ooh, that's kind of exciting. That's kind of interesting. But let's examine that. Organic molecules formed. Well, that's just a couple of carbon atoms connected to some nitrogens, oxygens, and hydrogens. That's an organic compound. It's not alive. It's the kind of thing that makes up life, okay? And what do you get? You get tens to hundreds of these in the water from that lightning strike, etc. An amoeba, a single-celled amoeba, has tens of millions to a billion organic compounds in it, carefully orchestrated, specifically placed to create the amoeba. So the step from going from these tens to hundreds of organic molecules in this little soup to a single amoeba is an amazing leap of faith, right? And it fights against entropy, which says, no, they're going to spread them out. And that's me glazing people over a bit, but that's what entropy does. So how do you get from that? From about 10 to hundreds of these to amoeba? Magic, right? Looking more specifically at evolution, more problems crop up. If all life evolved from single-celled creatures, which is a huge leap to even understand how the single-celled creature came into existence, then where are the two-celled creatures? Where are the four-celled creatures? There are single-celled creatures, bacteria, amoebas, that kind of stuff, and then there's amazingly complex creatures called humans and bats and birds and lizards and things like that. Nothing really in between. Well, if evolution's true, there should be things in between. Two, there should be things propping up that are on their path to eventually evolving, etc. Doesn't really exist. Okay? And one of the things that evolutionists fight is how designed everything appears. I really love this. I read this one, I left his name out, but he's an atheist biologist, and he said, Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Let's say that again. They give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. What is he saying? He's saying the evidence says purpose. But I know there's not a purpose. I know there's not a designer. So my version of biology is how I show that despite the evidence, there's no designer. That's a huge leap of faith, and you're not even standing on the evidence anymore, right? And so to admit that the evidence implies design is a huge leap of faith. And I can keep going, okay? Evolution cannot explain the diversity of life on the planet. The understanding of DNA has resulted in calculations of, in order to make a single leap in evolution, the chance is 1 in 10 to the 77th, okay? That means evolution should take hundreds of millions time longer than their timeline says, i.e., impossible. Huge, monstrous leap of faith. I read an article about how the objections to evolution are usually based on Christian arguments. It's religious people who disagree with evolution. Well, I guess I qualify for that. And they use religious arguments to disprove evolution. I don't think I brought up a single Christian argument in my diatribe. So let's summarize, and I have a slide for this, and I apologize, 3 of the next 4 slides are really eyesores. But I wanted to fit a lot on there. I should have one that says summary slide and all the, there it is. I might have them out of order. Everything came from nothing. It started moving away from the center for no understandable reason. It slowed for no understandable reason. Stars were able to form because due to this undetectable, unseeable matter that we do not know where it came from, but it has a strong gravitational pull, but we can't detect it. Single-cell organisms sprung to life from nothing, ignoring entropy. These single-cell creatures evolved into a diversity of living creatures that we have today, despite any real evidence of being able of that being able to happen. No examples of more complex organisms, less complex those, and honestly, so much more. That is a leap of faith. Okay, that is why that one line is underlined. Why is that one line underlined? Because that's the only thing on that list which has been somewhat observed. That's a leap of faith. And if you think about the narrative in Genesis, it explains the origin of the universe. It explains the origin of stars, the earth, the how many different kinds of diversity of organisms we have. It's almost as if the author of Genesis knew that this was going to be a debate. Just saying. So let's be fair. Let's look at the other side of this, okay? And doing that, I'm going to lean very heavily on C.S. Lewis. When we look at Jesus, there are a couple possibilities. Now we're ready for that one slide. That one. He's legend, he's a liar, he's a lunatic, or he's Lord. Okay, so we're going to start with legend. Did Jesus even exist? Well, the first account we have, of course, is the Bible, right? We have three Gospels, which were eyewitness accounts. And then we have Luke, and Luke is always a real problem for people who want to disprove the Bible, because this is a guy who says, I did research, I talked to people, you know, etc. You know, he's the only one who has the early lives of Jesus. Why? Well, because the three eyewitnesses weren't with him for those things, but Luke talks to Mary and says, tell me about the early things. And so here you got this guy who really does it. So in order for, and then we have the disciples, Polycarp, Ignatius. And what's really neat about all these people, they wrote about Jesus, and they wrote about people who knew Jesus, and they mentioned sometimes, hey, you know, there's still a lot of people who saw Jesus. There were 500, and Paul writes this, there are 500 who saw him and this one particular thing. And, you know, some of those people have fallen asleep, but most of them are still around. You can go ask them. Who writes that, right? Chances are, if you write that, you're welcoming the challenge, and there's people around who would have known it was not true if it wasn't true, okay? But I also wanted to pull in a couple of non-Christians from the time and see what they said. So the first one, slide, is Tacitus. He was a Roman historian and politician. Consequently, he says, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class of hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. A most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, but the first source of evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Now, this is written, from, you know, and let's do the second one. Pliny the Younger. By the way, Pliny the Younger also wrote about wine. It's not a front word. He was a lawyer and author and magistrate at ancient Rome. He wrote, they, the Christians, were in the habit of meeting in certain places fixed day before it was light, and when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as a God, and bound themselves by solemn oath not to do any wicked deeds, but never commit fraud, theft, adultery, and so on. These are people who are not Christians, who at the time write about both Christ and the Christians, right? They had no reason to pass a false narrative. They wouldn't have done it, you know. And I think it's, you know, Tacitus is so amazing how much he wrote exactly the story we have, you know, in the Gospels. Okay? So I want to go back to this slide. That one. As I continue, I want you to think about what's happening to that bottom bar as the evidence mounts. And so, you know, we've just looked, you know, and I think, you have to come to the conclusion Jesus existed. I remember reading something. I actually didn't write this in here because I couldn't find it again. But I remember reading years ago that we actually have more evidence that Jesus existed than Julius Caesar. But I couldn't find that, so you know, watch that one carefully. Was Jesus a liar? To start with this one, you really have to start with, did Jesus claim to be God? Okay? You know, the Muslims will tell you Jesus never claimed to be God. But Wallace has spent some significant time recently pointing out all the times that Jesus said, I am, right? And half those times, the Jews picked up stones to try and stone him. Why? Because they knew it was blasphemy if he wasn't God. Jesus also uses the term Son of Man, which is often misunderstood, but Son of Man actually comes out of Daniel. And in the 7th chapter of Daniel, God's authority and sovereignty is given to the Son of Man. So that's why Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, because he's calling himself God. And he says he's going to have all authority and sovereignty of God. Okay? And then, of course, he also said, the Father and I are one. And again, the Jews picked up stones at that moment. So the Jews knew he was claiming to be God. Trying to hold a position that Jesus never claimed to be God is undefendable. You must ignore too much of the evidence, which proves that he said it, but doesn't prove whether he was lying or not, or whether he's a lunatic. So let's look at that. What would be his motivation for lying? We get cult leaders these days. They get money, they get power, they get sex, right? Jesus did not have a coin to pay the temple tax. There's no evidence that he was ever trying to grab power. There's no evidence of any of the rest of that type of stuff. You know, Jesus and most of the disciples died then to protect the lie. Well, most people will not go and get crucified if they're lying, right? Let alone crucified upside down, let alone boiled in oil, you know, etc. And a lot of them were given the opportunity to just denounce. You couldn't get all of them to do that if it was a lie and they knew it, right? And I don't think you could expect for the disciples to have walked with Jesus all that time and not figure out that he's lying. And I haven't even touched the miracles and things like that of course have to exist in order to generate this kind of faith. But it just doesn't, it's pretty difficult to swallow that somehow he was lying and they didn't figure it out and then they were willing to die for it. Was he a lunatic? And his disciples fell for it. Again, we've got the whole miracle thing, which I'm not even going to bother with because I feel like that blows it out of the way. But let's look at other things, you know. His teaching is well-respected in many forums. Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. both drew from Jesus' teaching. Gandhi calling Jesus one of the greatest teachers of mankind. It is impossible that his 12 disciples followed him, to include the one that they added, because, you know, we have one that went off the deep end, but that was always expected. Is it possible for a lunatic to be consistent and fool people? Again, highly unlikely, and we have some other things. But I did ask it that way. Of course it's possible, but it isn't probable, right? This is not dark matter. We don't know where it came from. We don't really understand it, but there's lots of it, right? This is, no, I look at these two things. Is it more like he's a lunatic or more likely that they believed him and he was sane? Unfortunately, it's the second, if you will. Unfortunately, Gandhi calling Jesus a great teacher, though, is very interesting, because C.S. Lewis said, you cannot simply call Jesus a great teacher. You have to deal, as we are doing here, with his claim to be God. He's either crazy, the equivalent of a man who believes he's a poached egg. I love that line. Or he's lying, or he's Lord. The eyewitness evidence, Matthew, Mark, John, the researched evidence, Luke, found in the Bible, the collaborating evidence of secular writers that continued the faith following, walked, all give us evidence that Jesus was real, that he called himself Lord, and that you either have to accept it or not. But the evidence is solidly in our favor that it's real. So now turning to the Word of God, we find evidence to support our faith there too. Now remember, I'm not proving God exists. I'm showing that the leap of faith is not as uninformed as the leap of faith required to not believe in God. So the Bible, there's no book like it, right? It was written over 1,600 years, 66 different books, over 40 authors, 3 continents, 3 languages, and yet it comes together as one book. Last year, gave my sermon, I mentioned, as you read through the Bible, you read these 3 things. It is the unfolding revelation of Jesus Christ, the unfolding revelation of the redemption of man, and that the Old Testament contains physical pictures of spiritual realities in the New Testament. And if you read the Bible with those 3 things in mind, you will understand it a lot better than if you don't, if you simply state it. But what does that really mean? That means it's consistent. That when you understand what its themes are, the Bible is consistent. How do you get one book with that kind of a history to be consistent? Let's take a look at this slide. It's hard to see. What's going on here is you have all these circles back and forth, these arcs back and forth. And down below, there are little white lines. And what this is the Bible and all the overt cross-referencing. Remember, could you kill the lights for me for a second? There, Ray? Especially the ones up here so we can see this a little better. I would argue it was this little picture right here that kind of gave me the inspiration to do this. So this is the Bible and all the overt cross-references. And I think I actually failed to write that number down here. But it's like 66,000 cross-references, okay? If a single person had written this book, which of course they did, but if a single person had written this book and had managed to knit it together like that, they would be a master writer. But that's impossible with over 40 different authors, okay? You know, I don't think it's humanly possible to have written this book. Okay, unless the single person who wrote the book was God, because that is just insane. It has also been a great 100 years for the Bible. Much of it during my lifetime. When I was a kid, When I was a kid, I can remember articles that were like, "We're looking for this city, and it should be here. And since it's not here, the Bible is wrong." And then 20 years later, they dig a little deeper, and they find the city. And I'm like, well, if not being there means the Bible was wrong, does that mean being there means the Bible is right? Okay? I remember, this is another one I couldn't find, and I didn't actually write in here, but I love it. There's somewhere in the Bible, and I'm sorry that I'm going to be so generic, but where they were like, you know, I think it's in Daniel, where it calls out a king. And they had this thing, and that person was not on the... from Babylon was not on the cessation of kings that was recorded by Babylonian historians. And they were like, look, the Bible is wrong. And then about 20 years later or so, we found something that said, oh, and during this particular summer, which by the way matches, this guy was acting as king while the king was off to war. And that was the same name. So he was not truly the king. He was just acting as king. Well, that's like good enough for me, right? And again, you said because his name was missing, the Bible is therefore wrong. Now that he's there, does that mean the Bible is right? So, Jericho's a fun example also. While it was actually found more than 100 years ago, multiple things have been discovered that match biblical story. Okay, everyone who's done the digs has said, yep, the walls fell. But not all of the wall, and this is important, because Rahab's house was on the part of the wall. And so some portion of the wall had to stay standing, and did. There are portions of the wall that stayed standing. The way it fell out instead of in, which is unusual. Matches the biblical thing. They also were able to determine that the siege was short. Okay? And that the Israelites devoted the city to the Lord. And you're like, how do you prove those last points? That's like I said. There was a large amount of burnt grain found at Jericho. Significance of burnt grain, two things. If it had been a long siege instead of the 7-day siege, the grain would have been consumed, right? Second, it was burned. An invading army normally takes the grain, right? They need that, right? And so they wouldn't have, but what is Joshua saying? I have a slide for this, okay? They burned the whole city and everything in it, but put the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. So found was burnt grain, exactly what the Bible says you should be able to find. Do you know what was not found? Iron, gold, silver, bronze. You know, I cannot deny a fact. That could have been looted afterwards. But it's interesting that it actually matches. So let's kind of summarize this side, and I don't have a slide for this one. We have the eyewitness writings, Luke's investigation, writings of the disciples of the apostles, writings of historians and philosophers who were not Christians, but point to the same history. The eyewitnesses spoke of miracles, and that everyone, even non-believers today, often note that are amazing, the amazing teaching of Jesus. The Bible and how it has over and over again proved to be accurate as the archaeological discoveries have happened. And while I have not even touched the possibility of the most powerful proof, which is prophecy, the Bible contains over 2,500 prophecies, of which about 2,000 are readily seen as being fulfilled. Let's say we're fooling ourselves and we're only half right. So there's only 1,000 prophecies that have been there in the Bible, and I'm throwing out. I'm giving no credence. You know, no, there's no reason to believe this. But what if we're wrong? There's only 1,000 prophecies. There's no other place where you're going to find 1,000 prophecies that have been made and fulfilled, let alone 2,000. And what's really interesting is watching those other 500. So this brings me back to the last overhead. Does all of this prove that there is a God and that Jesus is him? No. I told you from the start, that's not what this was about. Okay? It always is going to require a leap of faith. Go ahead and do that. Yes, thank you. I just hold that the leap of faith is actually standing on real evidence and not massive holes. Okay? The leap of faith to believe there is no God requires crazy assumptions, ignores actual science. It's an illegal chess move. I was going to finish there, and I'm probably once again really quick. I was going to finish there, but looking into Gandhi's view of Christ, I found an unsettling quote of Gandhi that I wanted to discuss with us and challenge us. Gandhi said, "If it weren't for Christians, I'd be a Christian." Many Christians poorly represent Christ. And that is what a portion of this sermon was about today, realizing who Jesus really is, rather than the representation often of good-intentioned people in representing him. Gandhi saw so much in Christ, he would have followed him. But he saw the flaws of Christians as too great a proof to accept Christ. I would encourage us to let Christ shine forth. We will fail and sometimes get it wrong, but taking ourselves out of the equation as much as possible and showing Christ is the goal. The Bible is the unfolding revelation of Jesus Christ and the redemption of man. Half of the purpose of the Bible is to reveal Christ. The other half of the Bible purpose is to show what Christ did for us. It's all Christ, right? So Christ is paramount in both those messages. Paraphrasing the words of John the Baptist, we must diminish so that he can increase. Let us do that in all that we do. So with that, Lord Father, I do thank you. I thank you for this opportunity. As the psalmist said, the whole earth is filled with awe at your wonders. Where morning draws, where evening fades, you call forth song of joy. We stand in awe of your mighty power and the need we have of in our lives. I do pray for Wallace and Linda on their vacation. I pray you give them peace and recovery and eventually a safe journey back to us. I pray for this congregation and the hedge of protection that you've always provided us and the way that you provided for us. And I just pray that you continue to watch over us. I do pray that we become a beacon more and more to the area around us. In your name, amen.